name. Hit the theme song.
This is episode 4 of This Is Rocket Science,
the official Columbia Space Initiative podcast. My name is David Tibbetts.
My name is Henry Manowski.
And we'll be taking you through this wild space journey. Henry, what are we talking about today?
We're going to be talking about the leftover objects in the solar system from its formation. We're going to be talking about asteroids. Then we're going to segue into space mining. It's going to be a great time. We have like the biggest audience I think we've ever had, live audience, that is.
Yeah, it's absolutely enormous.
What's poppin', homie?
A
member of the last audience has asked us, what is poppin'? The answer is space. Space is poppin'.
She said it into the mic, so I think they could hear it.
Just want to make sure everyone knows we're on the same page. Anyways, space mining. Asteroids. Of course, for those of you who are watching for the first time and don't know who I am, I'm a geologist. Not really a rocket scientist. My good man Henry is more of the rocket scientist. I guess you could say I'm more of a rock scientist.
So this is sort of the perfect combination of those two disciplines, I think.
Without a doubt. But to start off, we should talk about what exactly are asteroids. Asteroids, of course, are any body of rock that is formed in space and remains there. It's important to talk about the fact that it remains there because there's different qualifications for space rocks when they're entering Earth's atmosphere and once they have struck the Earth. So an asteroid is anything that's still in space. As it is crashing through the atmosphere, it is called a meteor, and once it has hit the ground, it'll be called a meteorite. How do they form?
Well, they form like anything else in the solar system. The difference is that they don't coalesce into a planet. So when you talk about planets, there's several formal definitions that people use. So one of them is that they have to have enough of their own self-gravity such that they're in a spherical shape. And asteroids are just the leftover bits that didn't form into a planet or moon. So they're going around the sun and they're relatively small. Usually the biggest ones are like 100, 200 kilometers in radius.
Now one thing that's actually very interesting about the fact that they remain in space is that actually their composition is very similar to the composition of the solar system while it's forming. So the overall composition of an asteroid could be similar to that of the overall composition of the Earth. However, were we to want to extract metals and elements from it, it'd be much easier than to extract it from our own planet.
Because there's so little gravity.
Yeah, one of the problems with the Earth and finding high quantities of, you know, big metals is that when the Earth was forming, it was molten and all the metals sank down to the core. Asteroids were never molten, besides, you know, being gas. And that lets us extract metal much easierly. Definitely not a English major. There's another type of a body of rock in space called a comet. What's the main difference, Henry?
So there's a few differences. Probably the biggest difference is the shape of their orbit. So you have an asteroid and it usually has roughly a circular orbit, like the Earth. It has a very low eccentricity is the formal term, but comets usually have very, very high eccentricities, very, very highly elliptical orbits. So the unit that's commonly used is an AU. So one AU is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun, 93 million miles. A comet, its orbit at its closest approach could be 0.1 AU, and its farthest could be 10,000 AU. So it's really going really far away, coming really close in, and it has a lot of dynamic properties because of that. Most notably, as it comes closer towards the Sun, all of the trapped minerals, not all of them, a lot of them, like ice, for example, sublimates directly to gas, creates this massive tail that's very beautiful to look at and very visible, a lot more visible than the actual core itself.
Now, one of the most famous comets that exists, of course, is Halley's Comet. I'm sure we've all heard the story a million times. Comes around once every 75 years. Everyone loves it. For the record, the next time that we predict we'll be seeing Halley's Comet is July 28th, 2061.
Jesus Christ.
Damn. We're going to be alive, probably.
In theory.
Hopefully.
In theory, we'll still be making this podcast. So,
I don't know.
Maybe not that.
I'm surprised we haven't had any questions from Micah. What's going on?
I do have a question.
Sure, we have a question from the last of the audience. Micah, come take the mic. Get Micah.
Okay, so I was wondering if asteroids are large space rocks with elliptical orbits, but they're smaller than planets, but bigger than, like, rocks, then what would make Pluto not be an asteroid?
It, well, it also depends on...
Hey, dude, I got
it. It is, and it's also not, sort of.
I think one of the main things is probably the fact that it's made spherical by its own gravity.
Sort of, yes. And also it's the fact that it's when people talk about asteroids, generally they're talking about objects in the asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
Pluto is farther out than Neptune. So it's way, way further out. Usually people say that Pluto is an object in what's called the Kuiper belt, which is different from the asteroid belt. So people will generally refer to Pluto as a trans-Newtonian object. But if we want to call an asteroid anything that's just left over in the solar system that hasn't formed into a planet or a moon, yes, then Pluto is an asteroid.
So, but it's also locational.
Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Interesting.
It's all semantics.
We have another question over there from the live studio audience. Elise, take the mic.
Why isn't Pluto a planet anymore?
True.
Pluto isn't a planet. There's sort of a... historical argument to be made when it comes to Pluto not being a planet. If you go back to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, there was astronomers discovering a lot of new objects in what we now call the asteroid belt. Objects like Ceres, Vesta, objects that were smaller than the moon, but still pretty big, visible to those astronomers. So we called them planets. And then all of a sudden, we found Ceres, Vesta, and then all of a sudden we found like 10 other objects, roughly that size, sitting in the asteroid belt. And then astronomers sort of realized that it would be more useful to give objects of that size range and in that area a different distinction.
They're not really planets.
Because they're not really planets, because it's kind of ridiculous to have like 40, 50 planets. Yeah. A very similar thing has happened.
You see, when I was a kid, there were 9 planets, but... If we let that go off, we'd have 90 planets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so Pluto kind of got umbrellaed in with that, and then they were like...
Yeah. Well, so once we decided that objects like Ceres, Vesta, and the asteroid belt weren't going to be planets, and it was fine for like 50 years, Pluto was found, we decided Pluto was a planet, and then in the late 90s, like early 2000s, we started discovering a lot of objects around the size of Pluto farther out than Neptune. So a very similar, very analogous situation to what's happening at the early 20th century. And we actually found an object bigger than Pluto. But we didn't want to call that a planet because of the issue that they ran into before. We don't want too many planets. So that's when, I think it was 2006, we just decided Pluto's not a planet, none of these are planets. We will have 8 planets. So yeah. And that was Neil deGrasse Tyson who had a hand in doing that.
Really?
Yeah, he was on the committee that killed it.
Neil, I respect your decision.
No, honestly...
He did what he had to do.
That is the most heinous form of sizeism I think I've ever... When is someone going to put their foot down and say, cosmic size doesn't matter? We need to respect planets of all shapes and
they
sizes.
They can be a dwarf planet.
A dwarf planet. That's such a... No... That's such a cop-out. You have to give it the full title.
Anyways.
How do you think Pluto feels about all this?
It's a piece of rock. It doesn't have feelings. Moving on, of course, we're talking about asteroids and stuff. One of the biggest things we need to learn about asteroids is their composition. It's kind of hard to learn exactly when most of our research comes just from impacts. Of course, some of the best research come out of that is definitely from the meteor crater.
Your native Arizona.
As a tourist, yeah, I am from Arizona. I've been there twice? Enough times. It doesn't change at all, besides like minor amounts of erosion from like the one time it rains a year. But yeah, craters like that, of course, the Barringer Crater is one of the best sources for scientific information about impacts, just because it is so well preserved. It's only about 10,000 years old, but that's pretty old in comparison to how quickly things can erode on this planet. it kind of cheated in the erosion field because it was in Arizona, is in Arizona where it just never ever rains. It's not like here at all where it rains every single day.
Mm-hmm. There's also bigger impact craters. So there's the Chicxulub crater, which is where the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs hit, like 65 million years ago, whatever.
Out in Yucatan, mm-hmm. Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. Mexico.
There's also even bigger craters that occurred, you know, where the impacts occurred billions of years ago. And we can really only see the outlines of those craters. So the biggest one of all is in South Africa. And it's difficult to tell that it's even a crater until you go to space. And then you can see this like very geometric outline. There's also one in Canada that's really big. Yeah.
I don't remember the name of it or exactly where it's at. Although I have heard a theory once. It was probably not any kind of thing legitimate, but I heard a theory of someone looking at a bunch of massive meteor impacts and a map of the tectonic plates and trying to find a connection between where the plates were at the time of collisions and perhaps if these collisions could have sparked the movement of the plates. Now, I don't know how much that's possible.
Yeah.
I come to think that it's not very likely. However, it's an interesting thing to think about. Could a meteor actually move or change the direction of movement of an entire plate of rock?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely pack a lot of energy.
They have a lot of energy coming behind them. Because they're moving some like 10,000, 20,000 miles per hour when they hit the ground, right?
Easily.
Easily,
sometimes they're like, you know, like 20 kilometers a second. And if it's like the size of a city, well, that's depositing a ridiculous amount of kinetic energy. So
could they theoretically like create a new continent? Like, are we just the next Pangea waiting to explode into the seven continental regions?
Moving on.
We're gonna ignore that question.
Why?
The next thing we can talk about though is since our research on Earth is limited, of course, ideally we want to go research asteroids out in space. Henry, you're going to know a lot more about this than I'm going to know. What are the most recent missions to asteroids?
So there was one actually like a month ago, maybe 2 months. There was JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, sent out a probe to an asteroid, and they started actually deploying landers to it. And we got like really crisp images from the surface. It was really cool. And the first one was near Shoemaker, which was in the late 90s. That was NASA, landed on Eros. And the reason why they're doing this, the reason why it's so relevant, is because what you mentioned before, which is that the composition of these asteroids are the composition of, or is the composition of the early solar system. So if we want to study the early solar system and our past, I guess, in like a cosmic sense, then we really need to understand the composition of these asteroids. Some of them are, in fact, sample return missions. So the recent JAXA mission is a sample return mission. So we're going to get a lot of data from the surface, and we're going to bring a sample back and get even more data, get to analyze it in really good labs. So
that was going to be absolutely incredible. Speaking of asteroids and asteroid impacts, of course, I think it's a big saying. You know it pretty well.
Someone once said, asteroids are nature's way of saying, how is that space program coming along? Basically, it's the idea that...
every time that something comes close to hitting Earth, everyone freaks out and says, all right, well, could we actually stop that?
Mm-hmm.
And we're always going to ask, you know, NASA, the government, we're going to say, are you prepared to stop an asteroid? And the answer is...
Sort of.
There's a couple of theories for how we could stop asteroids. And it kind of depends on how much time we have from detection.
Definitely.
Obviously, if we have less than a year to stop an asteroid, there's only really one course of action, and that's, you know, the Armageddon movie. Set a nuke up there, blow it to bits, hope the little bits don't hit anything big.
Hope, basically.
Yeah, hope. It's a very... But one of the cooler theories is, of course, when you have several years of detection.
Mm-hmm. If you have a few years or even like a decade before you know this asteroid is going to hit us, there's a few more subtle things that you could do to stop an asteroid. And probably the easiest of which is just send a spacecraft to the asteroid and then just sit there. Because the asteroid is so small and has so little of its own gravity that the gravity of your spaceship is comparable to the gravity of this asteroid, so you could just drag it away from its course. And if it's 10 years away, you don't need to drag it off far at all.
You drag it off a tenth of a degree, mm-hmm. and it can miss the Earth.
Yeah, completely miss
the Earth. That's just because of how big the entire solar system is, the entire universe is.
Huge.
The smallest change.
Huge.
It's a huge change. Maybe cut that part out. Anyways, another thing is, perhaps the Space Force could play a role in this, people say.
We've talked about the Space Force a lot, especially episode 2, I think it was.
It was in the title.
Yeah, it was in the title. So you could go back to that episode if you want to see us talk about the Space Force. But right now there is nothing in the sort of doctrine of the Space Force that would give them the responsibility of stopping an asteroid. So as of right now, it's still, I guess, hypothetically NASA's job. Although it also isn't in NASA's stated goal to do anything about it. But presumably, if an asteroid was going to hit us, someone would step up and do something.
Elon?
Elon
Musk, we're counting on you. Could you imagine...
Should have Tesla at the asteroid.
That's right, because
that
if you only,
so
you only need to put a spaceship next to it to
just
grab
a Tesla.
Just send a Tesla up there.
Tesla just saves the Earth.
That'd be insane, dude.
That'd be great.
I want that to happen now, actually. Could you imagine if Elon Musk saved the Earth? He'd be like a planet-wide George Washington.
He basically already is.
There'd be statues of Elon Musk in every single city.
All right. Space mining. That was not a transition at all.
That was
the
most
have
horrible
a real
transition.
Transition. It's recording.
Henry, I swear to God, if I'm listening to the podcast and this is still in it, I'm going to be very, very upset with you.
Why not leave it in? It's good banter.
This is literally just like a 15-second moment.
We have a bloopers.
We should have
a
bloopers.
Episode, yeah.
And it'd just be all Micah. Every single time we got cut out. Like that time you talk about neo-slavery.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
That was the dumbest thing.
That was so
First
dumb.
First of all, it was nano-slavery.
Have you guys ever seen the movie How I Shrunk Your Mother?
It's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids at Alex.
I left the journey to the center of the Earth, but for Mars, I left that one in episode 2.
Really?
Yeah, it was hilarious.
Episode 2 was a good episode.
I'll have to go listen to that.
Plus the Wolverine comment by Kate. Kate, do you have any questions for us, by the way?
No, I'm not inspired yet.
Does anyone have any questions at all?
About what yet?
About anything.
Be more inspired.
I really think you should cold email Elon Musk and just like...
That's not a question.
Tweet him. We'll start a Twitter campaign.
Yeah,
he's really into like anime. So like if we tweet him like an anime meme or something.
Hey, watch your language. We're recording right now.
It's really funny because the episode 2 is bleeped so much.
Really?
Yeah.
That is funny.
Maya,
a lot of
work
is so annoying.
Maya, do you have a question?
I was just gonna ask if there was like any evidence that an asteroid hit and killed dinosaurs. That's not your specialty, I don't think.
Oh yes, there actually was. There's
yeah,
a layer of iridium on I forget which part. It's right after the it's right before the quaternary, right after the one of the periods. 65 million years ago, about. There's a layer of iridium in the rocks. It would suggest that there was something. It's universal too, it's all over the Earth, it's the same layer. A stone, which suggests that something had deposited itself over the entire Earth. The theory there is, of course, that it was a meteor impact. There's a big meteor impact, of course, the one in Yucatan. This is in the exact same time frame. We think that that's the one it might have been. Of course, it could be a weird iridium volcano. Odds are unlikely that it's going to be a...
Iridium
is such a rare
element super rare
on
Earth,
and
it's actually like an asteroid that's way more...
It's way more common because all the iridium would have sunk to the center of the Earth,
mm-hmm.
or at least a lot deeper than we'd see it now. Of course... meteorites being the same composition as the beginning of the solar system are going to be much more dense in iridium. That's the big evidence for it. You know, the fossils end at the same time. It's a big layer of the same, you know, extraterrestrial element, and it's a big crater at the same time. Kind of all just stacks up. But yeah, it's an important question. We actually did have it listed on our little outline, but we skipped over it.
That's a good question.
A very good question. I think now it's time to transition to talking about space mining.
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill?
don't know.
We're not going to drill into an asteroid for, like, oil.
Idea.
I don't even think you can get space oil.
Dude.
Helium-3.
That's a moon thing. That's not space oil, though.
Do you know where the moon is located, my homie? Hello.
What's poppin'? Welcome to the Columbia Space Shooter Podcast. Do you have any questions about space?
Just gonna put her on the spot like that.
What do you think about Elon Musk?
Love Elon Musk.
Love Elon so much.
We love Elon Musk in the chat.
Talking about Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is like Dr. Doofenshmirtz, bro.
He just drops the mic. You guys
hear it?
For the record, I should recap. Someone just walked into this live studio, into the studio. Someone walked into the studio. I don't know why they were here, but we asked them if they had any questions. They asked us, what do we think of Elon Musk? Henry, what's the answer?
We love Elon. We love him so much.
We love Elon. We are big Elon stans here.
We want to be employed by Elon after we graduate, please.
You might not have heard her. Just want to clarify. Worst case scenario, just cut it out.
Yeah, we can just cut it out.
Just cut it out. Anyways, space mining. One of the biggest questions of space mining, of course, is how relevant even is it at all? As it stands,
not
particularly,
yeah.
Because to get out. Okay, one thing we talk about when we talk about mining ever is something called ore. Anyone who's played Minecraft has heard the word ore before. Ore is not really just something that contains the metal that you want. Several other factors go into it. It's really more of an economic term than anything else. It's more the consideration of how much money you have to spend to get something out of the ground, or rather to collect a resource and refine it, versus how much money you can get from selling it. So for example, if we have two identical bodies of rock, and one's at the surface and one's 10,000 miles beneath the surface, it's going to cost you a whole bunch of money to dig up 10,000 miles of rock above the body of ore before you can get to it. And that's all money you're spending until you get there. Same thing applies to space. The huge gap from getting to Earth to any asteroid you might want to mine kind of outweighs the profit you could get from this thing. As it stands, not very relevant, but of course, as we continue expanding into space, our infrastructure grows, one day it will be. And in fact, it's actually going to be a huge thing when we can get it going. Because one of the biggest problems with space expansion, of course, is a lack of materials. It's very hard to get things out of the Earth's orbit in order to be able to use them in space. Of course, that being said, if we could process and refine minerals from asteroids in space, there'd be a huge decrease in transportation costs for metals, which would allow us to build much bigger structures in space. Of course, we talked about this a lot more in the first episode of the Megastructures podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Huge potential for expansion.
Yeah, the highest cost when traveling to space is getting into and then eventually out of the orbit of the Earth. So if we were like already at an asteroid and we could just build a space station, build a ship out of the minerals that are on that asteroid and then bring it to, I don't know, the moon, that would be way, way less fuel intensive as trying to launch an entire station or trying to launch an entire ship with a massive payload from the Earth's surface.
Without a doubt, and with the same cost, once the infrastructure exists, you could get way more material than you could from Earth. And plus, that being said, we could also, it'd be way easier to get that material back to Earth. We could build a lot bigger structures on Earth for a lot cheaper. Of course, that's kind of more of just a big dream. Kind of would ruin the mining industry on the Earth, which kind of sucks because I really like minerals. And it's not really cool minerals in space. Actually, that's funny. We should talk about this. Why aren't there crystals in space, Henry? Do you know? Of course
there's
not.
There's no water. I know it
thing.
Only because we already recorded
we filmed this
episode,
podcast three
yeah.
times. I'm going to pause real fast, take a question from the live studio audience. Yes, Kate?
Define crystal? Yeah.
I can't define crystal.
No, it's a geometric arrangement of molecules together. Most oftentimes it occurs with inorganic substances, but oftentimes actually you can get it with organic molecules.
So you said there's no crystals in space?
Correct. I mean, not the same as here.
Okay, because I was thinking of my teacher described it as being like diamond in the center.
carbon. I mean, there is a lot of dense carbon there, but it's not quite the same as hydrothermically created crystals.
But Jupiter's got ice crystals.
Hmm?
Crystals are created in water?
Yes, crystals. Okay, so it was kind of not very space-related, but it is interesting. There's other ways the crystals form, of course, but the most common way we see on this planet is hydrothermic deposits of minerals, or hydrothermal deposits of minerals, rather. It's a hydrothermic process. And it's where water seeps into the earth via cracks. Usually it's along just regular fault lines, not like huge tectonic fault lines. And it'll actually get into bodies of magma that are superheated, that have these elements in them. And because of the high temperature, the water can actually manage to dissolve things that normally would not dissolve. And then once it's all superheated, it'll rise right back up the cracks. And once it gets to higher elevations in the earth, it'll cool off and deposit these elements. And of course, as they deposit, they'll form little compounds. Take, for example, quartz. This is super common in hydrothermal deposits. It's silicon dioxide. There's a bunch of silicon, a bunch of oxygen that's been dissolved in the water, and as it cools off, it all just conglomerates together into little hexagonal pointy crystals. They're very cool. Of course, you don't see any kind of geometric shapes like that out in space because they didn't have the same... They didn't have water as the solution to give
like
them
flowing
the...
Flowing
yeah, you couldn't flow, you couldn't... Yeah. Couldn't quite get arranged like that. Although, Chris, you do get densities of elements and stuff in space, because it's a similar thing. As a gas, as it's conglomerating together, similar compounds will combine with similar compounds, but not quite in the same shapes. Another question for the rest of the audience?
So, it's confirmed that there's water on Mars, frozen underground.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Are there crystals on Mars?
Oh, a most excellent question. Are there crystals on Mars? You see... I'm actually so excited about this. It's been a recent discovery no one knows about because no one really cares about it. I met this guy, Bob Downs, from the University of Arizona. He's the head mineralogist on the Curiosity Rover program. And he actually showed us some pictures of gypsum crystals on Mars. Gypsum does a phenomenon similar where something's dissolved in water and then is deposited. It's a bit different because this is more of an evaporite mineral where the water can actually hold it at just about any temperature. But just like salt crystals you make in a cup, when it dissolves, it can hold less. Or rather, when the water evaporates, it can hold less of the thing. It's another thing that happens. But yeah, we've seen veins of gypsum on Mars from Curiosity, which is very, very cool.
I think that's how they... So first, they proved that there used to be liquid water flowing on the surface of Mars. And I'm pretty sure that's how they proved it. More recently, we found... flowing liquid water on Mars that's like super salty and like not
another thing
drinkable.
Too is,
but
curiosity
salt crystals, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so
that's actually one of the ways they actually were figuring out the presence of water at one point was they looked at a lot of erosion patterns and sedimentary deposits just around Curiosity and their rovers. And they saw, of course, the same patterns we see on Earth where, when water flows by something and goes away. There is certain patterns we see in sedimentary rocks. I don't know enough about the terminology because I'm more of a mineralogist than a sedimentologist. But that being said, a big question for a while was, how can we tell that it actually is water and not just some other flowing substance? Perhaps it's methane, perhaps it's CO2, perhaps it's just a gas that's flowing. And they did a lot more research on it, looking at the angles, looking at what the velocities of the fluid would have been. From that concluding what the mass of it would have been, and they're pretty certain that it was definitely water.
And now we've actually found flowing liquid water.
Of course, we found flowing
liquid
water.
But it's like super, super salty. Like if you drank it, it's essentially poison. But there are like massive deposits of ice on both of the poles. So like we know that there's water. It's just not abundant in the liquid.
That's correct. Ice does form crystals. Ice is a mineral. Well. Earth is in space.
Earth is
in space. Uh-oh.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I've been debunked.
We got him.
Exposed.
Anyways, back to space mining. Of course, you could mine things on Mars. You could mine things on the moon. Except you won't.
Yeah.
There is metals on the moon. Or there are metals on the moon, rather. They're not dense enough to mine. One of the problems, actually, with the metals on the moon... It's way less dense than on the Earth because, of course, we have the formation of the Moon. We're struck by another planet, another large body, ejected a bunch of material in space, which all conglomerated into a Moon. really funny is, people don't realize this, well, I'm trying to think about it, but the body that hit the Earth hit it at an angle such that only the top layer of the Earth was actually ejected at all. And of course, since the Earth was molten and all the material had sunk to the center already, the outer layer was the least dense in metal. And that just leaves the moon a weird just body of more just silicate than anything else,
mm-hmm.
which kind of sucks.
But there are some...
There are some things, that's right.
Some interesting things that we can potentially mine. Probably the coolest of which is helium-3. So the moon doesn't have an atmosphere like the Earth does. The moon doesn't have a strong magnetic field like the Earth does. So the moon is just getting hammered by solar radiation. So all these charged particles coming from the sun. You could even have like interstellar particles. All of this stuff is hitting the moon, energizing particles, and it can create helium-3 on the surface. So there's confirmed deposits of helium-3. And that's really relevant to science, because helium-3 is largely thought of as the most viable substance for nuclear fusion. And if we could do nuclear fusion, if we could do a large-scale nuclear fusion plant, it could pretty much solve all of the world's energy problems. So that's a big deal.
So I know right now we generate nuclear energy with fission mm-hmm. as the process. What's the logistical chemical differences between that and fusion?
All right, so
it's just
as it sounds.
Love it.
So fission, of course, is the process of splitting atoms and releasing energy.
Should we wait for this time?
It'll actually good call, Elise.
Ah, what's up, guys? I think Mike also pick up gun sounds. Sorry.
I think we're good.
All right, so we've been asked the difference between fission and fusion.
Mm-hmm.
A great question, actually. So fission, of course, is the process of splitting an atom. Most often times it's associated with uranium, plutonium, thorium, because these are such big atoms. I mean, uranium is 92, I think thorium is 93.
Mm.
They're so big, you can throw a neutron at it and it's likely to hit something. Or you throw one neutron at a bunch of it, and that could hit something. Or if you throw two big clumps of it together,
mm-hmm.
they're likely to cause a reaction.
And also it's so big in the first place that it's just begging to blow apart.
Oh, it's not as stable as something smaller. You would have a hard time splitting apart a helium atom.
No.
That being said, when you have small things, it's easy to put them together. Now, the sun, for example, operates off of fusion. Fusion is the combination of two atoms into a brand new atom. So the easiest thing to think of is you have two hydrogen atoms, both have one proton, and you combine them. You now have a helium atom with two protons. That releases a lot of energy as well.
Mm-hmm. In fact, more energy per mass. And also it creates less waste. So when you do fission, part of the sort of political issue surrounding doing nuclear fission for power, at least here in America, is where you're going to put all this radioactive waste. And what is that, like Yucca Mountain in Nevada they're talking about?
Yeah.
But, like, that was sort of shut down, and it's generally a super, like,
I say we just throw it in the sun.
Throw it in the sun.
Actually, it's not a bad idea.
That would be very fuel inefficient. But, But doing fusion,
fair.
Look cool.
Doing fusion is awesome because there is no waste product. Like literally, the only thing produced is energy. In fission reactors, there's in modern reactors not as much, but there is still a potential for meltdown. So, for example, we saw in Fukushima, there was a tsunami. The power was shut down, and the background power was shut down at a power plant, at a nuclear power plant, and then they had no way of cooling down the water that was used to cool these rods of uranium as they were undergoing fission. So the water overheated and the whole place overheated, and it was a very dangerous situation. With fusion, you have this tokamak reactor, and you have this ball of plasma at the center that's heated to millions of degrees. And then, say the power shut off, say, like, you know, worst case scenario, all that's going to happen is that ball of million degree helium will expand, and then it will cool, and because it cooled, then it can't do fusion anymore. So the reaction is just going to stop and nothing will happen. So there's basically no way to melt down a fusion reactor. So it's safer, produces more energy. And in terms of like realistic sci-fi methods of energy production, fusion is probably the number one way.
Of course, the biggest problem with fusion is it's so dang hot.
Yep.
You can't just solve that with AC, you can't just solve it with water, because you can't really put water on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if you try to put water next to it, you have to give a lot of it. We're getting there.
One day.
And worst case scenario, we'll just do it in space anyways, and
yeah,
space can get hot. Who cares?
Who cares?
I wonder if we'll see a big environmental thing to protect, like, just the vacuum.
One day.
So, when will space mining happen? I'd give it about 50, 60 years.
Yeah, I think 60 years is a good number for, like, sustainable, long-term space mining. I have a feeling that in the next 20, 30 years, we could see, like, a single mission where they try to do space mining.
I'm sure, yeah, that'd be actually, we'll probably see that pretty soon.
That's actually
just to see
if
we could even do it at all.
Yeah, part of NASA's Gateway project is taking a near-Earth asteroid and bringing it into orbit around the moon and mining it for scientific purposes, not like actually trying to extract anything and sell it or whatever. But that's space mining.
It's
going
to be a whole different
set
of metallurgical processes to refine minerals in space.
Yeah.
Because on Earth, it's really easy because all the same compound is collected together. Like when we want to, well, I think one I'm most familiar with is copper mining. We always want to try to find azurite and malachite because those are copper carbonates. You can react them into an acid and then just throw it into electrode and pull out the copper. But of course, we don't have sets of copper carbonate in space. It's just rocks that have a couple copper atoms here and there. Well, not a couple, a lot of them. It's gonna be a new process. We have to figure out new ways to process material in space. I don't know how we'll do it.
Are you downstairs?
But it's not a problem yet.
But I mean, there's so much money to be made in this industry. There's asteroids like Eros 433 that literally have quintillions of dollars worth of platinum. So as soon as...
I guess one of the big questions is will we see a private industry mine space?
So right now there's something called the Outer Space Treaty, which was signed by almost all spacefaring nations in the 1960s. It was based on the Antarctic Treaty. Basically, what it said was that everything in space is the property of all of us and none of us. None of us can privately own any part of space. We can't mine anything. We can't own land on anything. The problem with this treaty, in terms from the UN's perspective, is that it concerns outer space. And the UN has no space force, and it's really expensive to put things in space, put things and people in space. So hypothetically, if the US or if SpaceX landed on an asteroid, Elon, if he landed on an asteroid and said, this is my asteroid, I'm going to mine it, I'm going to make a profit on it, there's a UN treaty that says you can't do that, but there's also, like, what is the UN going to do? They're not going to send, like, there's no space police, like, they're not going to send someone to...
The Peace Corps.
Yeah, like, it would be so expensive and wasteful to enforce their treaties that sort of like it's unenforceable, basically.
Yeah. So, of course, Henry, we tried to tell a story about a million times on the podcast so far, and there is a really funny thing that happened regarding the Outer Space Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And someone trying to claim property in space.
Mm-hmm.
Henry, you love this story. You can
I
tell
love
it.
This story so much. So it was in the early 2000s. I believe it was like 2002. There's this asteroid that I had previously mentioned, Eros 433, which is super rich in natural resources like platinum, all that. And NASA landed a probe on this asteroid. But there was a plain old U.S. citizen who went on some website that would, I'm using air quotes here, would grant you like a land deed for places in outer space. Basically, there's websites that you can go to where you pay $20 and they give you a lunar deed or Mars deed or a deed for an asteroid. It's completely worthless. Like, they're just taking your money. They're cheating you. But he did this. and he decided he owned this asteroid. So NASA lands this probe on an asteroid, and they're like, this is an amazing achievement for the scientific community. We're going to learn so much. And he said, this is parking space 22. And he mailed NASA a $200 fine and said, this is my asteroid. You need to pay this parking fee. And NASA just said, we're not going to do that. You don't own the asteroid. But that was like a case study in, you know, the Outer Space Treaty. Who actually owns the asteroid? If, you know, maybe NASA does because they have sort of the power. They landed something. But this guy thinks he owns it. Then who can stop him?
I mean, who is NASA to say that that asteroid is not an interstellar parking garage? Like,
yeah.
What right do they have?
This guy paid good money for a deed to this asteroid. He should be able to make his money's worth.
I mean, he's just out here trying to live a very extended version of the American dream, and NASA's just
fulfilling Thomas Jefferson's ideal of, you know, going westward and owning a small tract of land.
Will we one day? We all remember, of course, the Louisiana purchase. Will we one day see the Uranus purchase?
You couldn't have picked any other.
Well, it's just, you know, on the far extents of the frontier.
I suppose, yeah. It's a fairly large land grant.
I would most certainly agree. I think it's just about time to bring it to the end of the podcast. Do we have any final questions, remarks, comments, admissions of love from the live studio audience? Anything else? Come on, you can't leave us hanging.
Dark matter looks like dipping knots.
Dippin' Dots are pretty good. I gotta admit that.
I think it's a good way to end the podcast.
All right, final agreement. Can I get everyone to say Dippin' Dots are good?
Dippin' Dots are good.
That was very enthusiastic. We can't leave that in.
It doesn't sound like there's a big live studio audience here right now. It's tragic.
Can we all say we love Elon Musk? All right, on three. 3, 2, 1. We love Elon. Hey. Elon. 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 This is Rocket Science's The Columbia Space Initiative podcast. Produced by Henry Manelski and David Tibbetts. Executive producer, Milan Anad. Audio is by Micah Weiss. Yeah, I'm just fades out there.
Okay. I'll leave this just for memes.
Oh, just for the banter at the end?
Memes, yeah.
Henry? You ever wonder why we're here?
No.